We delayed a little bit to let more people be seated. We have three argued cases this morning, and as probably most of you know, we will have a change of panel after the first case, and we will then adjourn for 10 or 15 minutes and return with a slightly modified panel. First case is Association for Molecular Pathology et al., a lot of al, versus Myriad Genetics et al., 2010-14-06. Mr. Castanhas, we have, as you know, allowed extra time, but we would hope and expect that you stick reasonably to the allotted time.
Thank you, Judge Lurie. Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. If I could beg the Court's indulgence for a couple of moments at the outset, I'll frame the three arguments that I'll make this morning. The first argument is our jurisdictional challenge. In the words of this Court's decision in Prasco, there is no real and imminent controversy that is traceable to the defendants in this declaratory judgment action. The only actions that occurred that were alleged to be performed by the defendants occurred long ago. And the district court's ruling in this case boils down to saying that Myriad's ownership of these patents is enough on their part to sustain a declaratory judgment suit on only a few of the claims.
Mr. Castanhas, yes. This isn't just an academic dispute by a few organizations or people opposed to gene patents. There are, among the plaintiffs here, physicians who would carry out tests. They've signed affidavits. As of fairly recently, saying they could or would engage in competitive activities. Myriad hasn't told them that they're entitled to a royalty-free license and that they wouldn't enforce their patents, have they?
No, Your Honor, and I don't think that's required by the...
So why isn't there a real controversy here?
Well, it's because this Court has asked for two things out of a declaratory judgment controversy. There have to be either actions or meaningful preparations by the declaratory plaintiffs, and there have to be, in the words of Sandisk, Prasco, and other cases of this Court, affirmative acts taken. It's a little too cute to say, but it does take two to tango.
There were letters sent out, one of them fairly threatening.
In 1998, I believe, and nothing has happened with regard to those.
Yeah. Nothing happened, actually. Counsel, didn't the recipients of the letter, the University of Pennsylvania Laboratory, cease and desist, just like the letter told them to do?
They did in 1998.
Right. So why aren't they still laboring under that threat? Myriad threatened them. They altered their behavior as a result. Why aren't they still laboring under that threat? They have no reason to think at this point in time that that threat is removed, that Myriad has ceased to feel the way it did when it sent them the cease and desist letter.
No, I think they have enormous reason to believe that that threat has been removed. If you look at the record in this case, for example, you have declaratory plaintiff Chung, who says that she's right now doing the sort of sequencing in her laboratory that
But not for clinical purposes. That was the distinction, correct? Myriad says you can employ these techniques for research purposes, but not for clinical purposes, as I understand Myriad's position.
Well, I believe that we've said that you can employ them for clinical purposes, but...
That's certainly her understanding from her affidavit.
Again,
is that she's not free to use them for clinical purposes. Are you saying that's not right?
Well, I'm saying that that's subjective. I mean, that's really Judge Price, and you're putting me on behalf of my client to the choice of having to tell you today that we will grant everybody here a royalty-free license so that they can do whatever they want in whatever way that they want.
All I'm addressing is your assertion that this Dr. Chung says she's free to do whatever she wants. Well, her affidavit makes it clear that she doesn't think she's free to do whatever she wants because she can't make use for clinical purposes, right?
And I think that's right.
But
she feels, and that's her subjective view, and that's fine.
That's not based in any way on a position that Myriad has taken with respect to the distinction between research and clinical uses.
It's certainly not based on any immediate position that Myriad has taken.
Is it
based on a position Myriad has taken? I can't get into her brain. I believe she says that she did, and so I'll take her at her word.
Okay.
But you know, what we have here is that Myriad, the last affirmative acts that Myriad took with regard to these patents were over 10 years before the suit was filed. And that's against MedImmune's requirement of a real and immediate controversy. And the questions that I'm getting, Judge Bryson, from you and from you, Judge Moore, are aimed at the other half of the declaratory judgment inquiry. As I was saying, it's a little too cute to say it takes two to tango, but it does take two to have a declaratory controversy.
No, yes. Counsel, I guess I'm looking at it as they're very much laboring under the continued threat of Myriad. The fact that Myriad said cease and desist 10 years ago or 12 years ago, well, they did. What reason do they think to have to think that Myriad is not still feeling very much the same way? I mean, Myriad had the power and authority to modify it. If they were no longer feeling that way, they could have let the plaintiffs know. They could have offered a covenant not to sue, but Myriad has declined to do so. Now, I'm not suggesting a covenant not to sue is required in any old circumstance, but in a circumstance where there has been an actual threat, an actual modification of behavior, maybe it's fair enough to say at that point the burden is on the patentee to show that the threat is not continued and real.
I think that you could imagine a case with different facts than this one where that might be appropriate. But what we have here is, we've said in our briefs, is a controversy that has largely been brought to the courts many, many years after the fact. You know, if there was a threat in 1998, then why wasn't the suit brought then? If there was a suit, if there was a threat perceived in 2005 when Ms. Matloff says that she called Myriad and received a call back saying those would be covered by our patents, why wasn't that suit brought then? I mean, there have been a number of this court's cases where less stale disputes, if you will, have been rejected with regard to declaratory judgment jurisdiction because the dispute certainly wasn't sufficiently imminent. And that's what we have in this case. I think there's another problem, Judge Moore, and we pointed this out in our briefs, that the claims in this case that are challenged were selected by the plaintiffs themselves. They are only 15 out of 179 of the patent claims that are in the seven patents that are in suit here.
Is this your redressability argument?
This is the redressability argument, Judge Moore. And if as they say, in fact, if you look at their affidavits very closely, you will see that they perceive the threat not from these particular claims, but from the patents as a whole.
So it's my understanding that they cannot obtain the relief they've sought unless they had challenged and possibly invalidated all the patents, because under the technology PCR, the probes and primers, none of that was challenged.
Correct.
There's no other way to obtain the relief sought.
Correct.
Absent using those.
Correct.
Well, you brought it up in the reply brief, which is fair game for a standing issue, of course. But we haven't gotten to see what they might offer in way of response to that yet.
I would like to see also, and they obviously had the opportunity, had they wanted to file a 28J letter on that or with regard to anything else in the reply brief, but I'm looking forward to that as well. And I think there is a significant problem with redressability because, you know, what is it that made these claims special? Why did they pick these claims for this case? I mean, there's a suggestion in a CNN article, which was in the record, that Mr. Ravitcher, the counsel for the plaintiffs, said that they just had to pick one case as their case, and they're really going after all gene patents everywhere. And, you know, if this is going to be the first brick in the wall, so to speak, well, that's all well and good, but that's really showing that this is a hypothetical dispute and not a real one.
Mr. Castanis, you've appeared before us on many cases, and you represent people on both sides. Aren't you troubled by the breadth of the district court's standing in this case? I mean, to reach individual people who want cheaper access to products, it seems to me, would be so broad as to allow any person that wants a cheaper product in any case to sue. I mean, gosh, Apple and Microsoft and everybody else would be sued by every consumer out there.
Well, I mean, even going aside from electronics, Judge Moore, I appear before you as a lawyer, but I'm a patient to a doctor sometimes. And I'm a patient who has to buy prescriptions at the drugstore. And if I want a generic drug that's cheaper, then I guess we don't need Hatch-Waxman anymore. I can just go in and file my own declaratory judgment action. I think the court appreciates the point with regard to the declaratory judgment.
But we have a multitude of plaintiffs here, not just a patient. We have physicians prepared to conduct tests who are in competition with Myriad. Potentially in competition.
Potentially in competition, right. But again, what has Myriad done to them? And again, with regard to affirmative acts aimed at anyone, there are only arguably three plaintiffs who might fit that. Those are the doctors at the Pennsylvania Laboratory and Ms. Matloff. And even then, the act of Myriad was only the response to a phone call, which I think this court made pretty clear in Innovative Therapies. You know, they're not going to let declaratory judgment be based on the sort of the gotcha of calling and saying, well, you know, can I practice this patent?
Well, you're leaving out
about
Mr.
Dr. Oster.
I'm sorry.
We're
yes.
On the same point.
Yes,
so
you're
okay.
Right. You're right. I left out Dr. Oster, but that's the same. That's the same with regard to the Pennsylvania labs. The same condition. I think this case should be dismissed on jurisdictional grounds. I'd be remiss if I didn't get to the merits. With respect to the composition claims, isolated DNA does not exist in nature. It has never existed in nature, and it never would have existed in nature except for human ingenuity and research.
Okay, before you get into the nuts and bolts of your argument, I just want to understand the scope of what you think your claim covers. If I were to endeavor to sequence the entire human genome, would your patent claims, the claims to the BRCA gene, read on my effort?
You want to sequence the entire genome?
The entire human genome, right?
Well, again, I have...
Of an individual. I mean, I am going to sequence my own genome.
Okay. Well, again, I think one of the problems, of course, is that this points up the lack of a meaningful dispute here. But I recognize that this case is made for hypotheticals and line drawing and all
is,
that.
But,
so,
but it's to me at least, it's an important question as to how preclusive your patent and any other patent on any particular gene would be if, in effect, you have to get 100, 200, 1,000 licenses before you can. Sequence the genome of an individual.
I'm not sure that my client has formed a view on that, and I'm not trying to avoid the question. With regard to the logical consequences of the claim construction, or at least of the meaning of isolated as it's defined in the guidelines, is in the PTO's utility guidelines. As long as the BRCA DNA is isolated, I can't imagine why that
wouldn't be covered.
Right, no, it wouldn't be covered because it wouldn't be isolated. If it were isolated, that would be a different story.
As long as you don't isolate that particular gene, if you do the genome test in something other than a gene by gene. Sequences.
Well, I would think that's right because what you're really talking about is the entire genome in effect in the same way as it is in your body. Now, again, the broadest claims here are drawn to an isolated DNA.
Yeah.
Now, if it's isolated, then arguably there's infringement.
Make sure I understand the science. So in Judge Bryson's hypothetical, it's the whole chromosome, therefore not isolated, therefore not covered by claims. You're not claiming the whole chromosome.
That's correct.
Right?
That's correct.
So, but if you do it on a, let's say, as I understand, one of the sequencing methods would be to take 32 nucleotide segments, one after another. If you do that, does that create a problem either with the any of the claims in general or specifically with respect to the 282 claims, I guess, 5 and 6, the 15 nucleotide segments?
I don't think it does if I'm understanding your question, Judge Bryson, because the definition of isolated includes separating the BRCA gene from the other genes in the genome. And I don't think what you're suggesting there would be that.
Does that include separating from introns as well?
Separated from introns, I would think that would at least arguably be covered by isolated, yeah. The main point with regard to the district court's error here is that the district court read into Chakrabarty, into Funk Brothers, a sweeping, and we've been pretty clear in our brief to describe it as a sweeping products of nature exception. But we can fairly easily admit that, as set forth in Chakrabarty, that a new mineral found in the ground or a new plant found in the wild is not eligible for a patent under 101.
If a new mineral found in the ground is not eligible, what if it's, you know, embedded in rock? You have to perform extensive excavation. You have to apply some sort of acidic substance to peel away all of the rock, effectively breaking the bonds that connect the mineral and the rock to each other. Mm-hmm. How is that really different than isolating the DNA?
Well, I'll answer it in two ways. First of all, I think it's not on some level different from isolating with respect to Section 101. Now, what you described, Judge Moore, is a rock with an embedded mineral in it, and then you have applied human interaction to separate it. Now, that is a composition of matter. It's within the language of the statute, and it is otherwise eligible for a patent. Now, the problem is, Judge Moore, just to finish the answer, is that patent would fail unless you give me more facts under Section 103, under the Funk Brothers analysis, because all you've done is the work of an ordinary skilled artisan with a jackhammer.
Or maybe even 102.
And maybe even 102, because somebody else did it before.
Well, at this point, why haven't all you've done is the ordinary skilled artisan? I mean, as I understand it, these geneticists are capable of doing this in quite routine and immediate fashion, and you can pick a gene in your body, and there's nothing particularly unique about BRCA1 as opposed to the gene for pancreatic cancer or the gene for Alzheimer's or any of these other genes. So why isn't this very much the skilled artisan in this field?
Well, again, this points up one of the problems, Judge Moore, with doing this with this coarse filter of Section 101. Now, Section 101 is not sensitive to sorts of things like the level of ordinary skill in the art. There's been no finding on that ground by the district court. There's been no finding with regard to what was known in 1995 when these patents were applied for. What's being argued is that there's this products of nature exception that it applies to this, and Judge Sweet, of course, says it's unique to DNA, but I think now that we're in an appellate court, we can see that this decision is going to have consequences for all sorts of areas, including other areas of the biotechnology industry. That's just not, those aren't considerations under Section 101.
Okay, I'm sorry. Can we go back to my hypo real quick before we move on? So my hypo about the mineral, is your position then that the mineral embedded in rock that takes the efforts of man to separate the rock from the mineral to get pure mineral, is your position then that mineral is now a patentable composition of matter and should be patentable subject matter under 101? Forget 102 and 103. Is your view that under 101 that mineral qualifies?
I would say that yes, although it presents a close case, it is patent eligible under Section 101.
But isn't it just something found in nature?
Well, it wasn't just found. I mean,
isn't
now you're sort of changing
that. The mineral is still the mineral when it's attached to the rock and it's physically compressed, but it's not chemically joined as a different molecular substance, whereas your gene is distinctly different in the isolated state from what it is in situ.
And we can certainly live with that distinction, Judge Lurie. That reflects sort of the CCPA's novelty analysis that said that if something is different in kind rather than different in degree.
Doesn't it reflect science in fact?
Well, it certainly does reflect science in fact, at least as I understand it. Again, you know, hypotheticals, I have to add a little bit more based on what I assume to be the ordinary level of skill with regard to the extraction of the rock. But one could imagine all sorts of inventive technological contributions that had to be made to get a rock out of a particular medium. We could just add facts, and so, you know, why should that rock be a composition of matter, but the rock that just took very simple work not be a composition of matter?
Well, that's the question. Tell me, why?
Yeah, when you say it takes complex efforts, I mean, mining can be a very complex enterprise, but you're not suggesting that mining for diamonds, which can be very expensive, difficult, and technologically challenging, renders the diamonds that are ultimately found patentable, right?
Oh, no.
I don't think
I used the word complex. I think I tried to use the term inventive technological contribution. I mean, we're, you know, after all, The patent system is a reward for inventors.
So are we saying then, with respect to the distinction between what is, as Chakrabarty referred to, a mineral found, discovered in the earth, are we distinguishing between a mineral which has to be subjected to a process that breaks covalent bonds between the mineral and some impurity that is not desired, versus a mineral that has to be treated, let's say, with a solvent to wash away those goods that those surrounding elements that are not wanted, where there are no covalent bonds that are actually broken? Is that the distinction we're to rely on?
If you look at the line of cases that has run from the late 1800s to today, you really do see that sort of distinction coming out of the cases. You know, if the mineral that's claimed as the result of your hypothetical patent is not functionally or structurally different than the mineral as it was in the ground, I have no problem closing the door on it at 101, and I think that's consistent with our position. But if there's invention, if this is the result of an inventor and it wouldn't have been there, it wouldn't have been added to the so-called storehouse of human knowledge but for human intervention, and human invention, I want to be very clear about that, then I think there you've got a line.
But presumably the invention can't consist of a new drilling device that is able to go much deeper and discover this mineral, even though when it gets down to the depth, that the mineral turns out to be in its native state.
No, I think that's right. And I think then you have to add a few more facts there to see the mineral where you're breaking the covalent bonds and you're creating something that really is new. And this is why I think that although the cases, I think, are not clear over the course of history, what you see distilled out of the cases are that you have Chakrabarty that says a product of human ingenuity. That's the language that I hope the court will focus on.
Why is the ingenuity the process as opposed to the resultant DNA, which is in your body? Why isn't the ingenuity the process of extracting it, the process of figuring out what it's useful for? Why is the ingenuity the thing? I mean, God made it. Man didn't make it.
Well, I mean...
Sorry, not supposed to say God in court, I know.
Well, I'm going to do it anyway, Your Honor. So imagine a baseball bat. I learned in English class when I was in grade school that only God can make a tree. But...
No, the
man
answer is in golf, only God can hit it one iron.
I would have preferred for purposes of my hypothetical that you used wood instead of iron, but I take the point. But the point is that what we have here are new tools, things that molecular biologists use. As Dr. Kay said in his declaration in this case, these are the products of molecular biologists. They're not the products of nature. They're not the products of God, if you will. These represent, again, quoting Chakrabarty, a product of human ingenuity. Just the tree, the baseball bat's inside there. It's the reason the baseball bat works is that it's got these particular qualities that are inherent in the wood. But I think, and I'm pretty sure I've seen patents, even maybe discussed by this court, that baseball bats are compositions of matter, manufacturers, patent-eligible subject matter. If I could very quickly turn to the method claims, because I'm getting close to running into my rebuttal time.
It's your time.
With respect to the method claims, I have 3 points very quickly. First, and I think we've made this pretty clear in our briefs, Judge Sweet committed a claim construction error. He seemed to view the term sequence, as it's used in the method claims, as referring to strictly information, strictly a series of letters.
Well, the method claims talked of analyzing, comparing, detecting. Isn't that all thought processes of visualizing as opposed to concrete steps?
Judge Lurie, I think your opinion for the court in Prometheus answers your own question. The court's Prometheus opinion looks at a claim that says determining, and says, well, it's necessary.
Determining is not in these claims.
Well, actually, it is in the claim 20 of the 282 patent. But
claim 20 stands in a rather different posture.
It does stand in a very different
posture. That's a growing.
That's a growing, determining, comparing claim. But with regard to the analyzing or comparing what? And the claims are clear. A tumor sample from a human subject, a germline sequence of a BRCA1 gene, these are things that are pulled out of a human body, and there's a necessary transformation. And I think, again, Judge Lurie, the opinion in Prometheus answers the claim on the other side about in re grams. This is not a case where this is just mere pre-claim data gathering. And I'll also urge the court to look at the recent Research Corporation Technologies case, which we cited in our reply brief, which deals also with a comparing claim. And those were upheld as patent-eligible subject matter. With regard to Claim 20 of the 282, Judge Bryson, you're right, it does stand in a very different posture. The district court held that this claim, which explicitly required growing a transformed cell, was not transformative. If that's not transformative, I don't know how anything could be. So unless the panel has further questions for me, I'll try to save the remainder of my time and surrender the podium.
We will save it for you.